This is R.J. Rushdoony, Easy Chair number 344, August 9, 1995. In this session, Douglas Murray, Andrew Sandlin, and Mark Rushdoony and I will be discussing euthanasia. I am not happy about discussing this. Rather saddened by the fact that it is an issue of importance and one that should be discussed. In my college days, I recall vividly that one of the things that marked Adolf Hitler and made his philosophy so detestable was the practice of euthanasia. And it was regarded as indicative of the evil of Nazism, that an abortion. And now, people who consider themselves to be liberal and enlightened are not only in favor of abortion, but now euthanasia. And the question that was raised in my youth as against the whole Nazi philosophy, and one which was shared by virtually everyone in this country, was if the state once decides that certain people, the elderly, the extremely sick, or the mentally retarded, as under Hitler, can be executed, then what's to prevent them from saying people of this or that racial background or color should not also be executed? Because once you've broken the barrier, it's simply a question of the state determining who it wants to get rid of. So the subject is a grim one. Once you breach the barrier, then there is no restraint whatsoever. Once you say that not God but man decides who shall die, then the society is going to go down the drain. I should add that there are too many people even in the church now, Catholic and Protestant, who don't know that God says that whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed.
Yes.
So we are seeing a serious situation where for lack of knowledge of the Bible and out of purely humanistic and sentimental concerns, people are ready to advocate euthanasia. Douglas, would you like to comment on the subject?
Well, I don't mean to trivialize it, but as you were speaking there, I almost thought popped into my mind that perhaps memorandums should be sent to some of these churches to remind them of God's law, because they apparently don't bother to read the Bible. Euthanasia is a very troubling subject. I've recently had to, actually over the past couple of years, I've had to deal with this subject in relation to my mother, who was very seriously ill over the past 2 years and in a convalescent home. And I was the first doctor that she had, called me at 11 o'clock at night. I'd never met this man in my life, wouldn't know him if I saw him on the street, and he's pitching me with the fact that I should sign a do not resuscitate form for my own mother. And I was enraged, and I fired him. And I got the next doctor I got. I said, don't bring up the subject, or you and I are going to fight. But you get it from, quotes, health professionals. And yes. I have, that word sticks in my throat.
Absolutely.
You know, health professionals who are supposed to preserve life are now dedicated to ending it.
Who are more interested in their profession than health.
Yeah, and the purpose is for the convenience of the medical profession, for the convenience of the apparatus that is supposed to take care of people of advanced age. Needless to say, I didn't sign any of these forms until it, you know, got to the point where my mother was, you know, being her time was had come. And then when I was in the room, I got there, I drove all night to get to my mother's bedside from Seattle, and I got there about an hour before she died, and I was holding her hand and reciting the Lord's Prayer, and the hospital administrator came in with these forms and demanded that I sign them. And I threw her out of the room. And I told my brother, you stand guard at the door, you know, until whatever's going to happen is going to happen.
Yes.
I said, don't let anybody in this room because I'm ready to swing.
Good.
I mean, you're just stunned. You can't, it's very difficult to believe, the crass level of insensitivity that these people have.
That's right.
It's a business to them.
Absolutely.
It's purely a business to them. But, you know, I'm amazed, particularly on television recently, we've had instances where newborn babes have been left in trash cans. And this is probably not a new phenomenon. It probably happened in biblical times up to the present. But what strikes me is that when television reporters go and interview, man on the street interview, what do you think about this? They don't know what to think about it.
No.
And, you know, it all goes back to when this abortion ruling was handed down by the Supreme Court. I just, you know, intuitively felt that, you know, we've gone around a big bend. We've gone over a big hill here. And it's going to have major repercussions down the line in the way people view the sanctity of life. And today, among the general public, there is no sanctity of life. They think more of their dogs than they do of members of their own family.
Absolutely.
And now you have 911 emergency people who are in the ridiculous situation of being required to give mouth-to-mouth or CPR resuscitation to animals, and yet they have to follow the dictates of signed agreements not to resuscitate certain people.
Yes. Well, this is a theological problem, as all problems are, because man wants to vest himself with God's sovereignty. I mean, that's the problem. Man wants to play God. When man no longer believes in the sovereign God of an authoritative scripture, then he wants to vest himself with that authority. And that's why life is considered so cheap today, because if you lose a proper view of God, you're not going to have a proper view of man, as Rush has pointed out for so many years. So this is, we can't, as perhaps some Roman Catholics and natural law people and many others, center it just on the suffering and problems of man. It's a theological problem. Men have a wrong view of God, a defective view of God. And that's why they treat their fellow man so wickedly.
I might have a slightly different a view of this, because I think sometimes we confuse some of the issues involved. Of course, there's obviously the euthanasia where you're actively killing people, which is, I believe, legal in the Netherlands, and I'm sure it goes on more in more cases than we're really aware. And of course, then there's the Kevorkian type of assisted suicide. However, there's the other element of allowing people to die naturally without a lot of artificial machines assistance. And I am not totally against letting someone die without hooking them to a respirator, if that is their wish. If you believe in heaven and you don't believe that living an extra day, an extra week, extra months is the most important thing, then you may be willing to accept that. And I think people have a right to determine what kind of medical care or lack thereof they receive. And sometimes doctors can go to extreme of sign, like you say, sign the papers, or they can go to the other extreme of, let's hook them up to this machine, let's get this going, we'll do this and that. And this may not be what the individual wants. If you don't want, you know, an abscess tooth removed, you have the right to be miserable.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And in pain. You have the right to the type of medical care that you want. And I don't think that we should say that there's an absolute moral necessity that we have to do everything
that's
medically
right.
possible mm-hmm. to prolong someone's life.
But that's a separate issue from euthanasia.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Someone else is
however,
making a decision for
however,
you.
I've noticed in the pro-life groups
mm-hmm.
have often confused the issue. And
that's because they're pro-life
matter of
and not pro-law.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's a matter, are you going to prevent someone from going on an artificial life system? Then there's a whole nother moral issue. Once somebody is put on an artificial life support system, do you remove them? 20 years ago, there was a famous case, mm-hmm. Karen Ann Quinlan. I mean, she was a household word for months because the legal debate went on and on and on. This was a girl who took drugs and alcohol. She was in a coma, mm-hmm. a vegetative state. And the argument, the legal battle was, if you remove this girl, you are committing murder because she will die if you remove her from artificial life support systems. The family, I believe it was the family, won the case. She was allowed to be removed from the artificial life support system. Lo and behold, the medical experts were wrong. She lived for just about a year after that.
Well, the difficulty is knowing when man is interfering with God's will,
mm-hmm.
and knowing when whether you understand what, you know, that it's God's will that someone is to die. This is, you know, what the medical ethicists are supposedly grappling with. But I think most people, most reasonable people, know when that time is. But when you hand this, when you write a blank check to a,
mm-hmm.
whether it's a hospital or to someone else,
mm-hmm.
then I think you're on dangerous ground.
The reason the hospitals legally like to have those forms is because once they put someone on a machine,
mm-hmm.
then it's a much more difficult legally,
sure.
It's a very difficult question on can they remove them from that machine. And that's when the court cases appear. It's the same thing as if somebody has a heart attack and you start CPR. If you're trained in CPR, legally you are required to continue CPR, and there are several conditions. One, if you're too physically exhausted and you cannot continue, or someone else continues that comes in that is qualified to take over for you, or qualified medical personnel declares that person to be dead. Otherwise, legally, if you start CPR on someone and you stop, you're in serious legal question, and it becomes that much more involved if in a hospital hooks someone up to a machine.
Yeah.
So part of the problem here is the assumption that man and the medical profession in specifically controls life or death.
That's right.
And that is the problem, is when we are determining whether this person lives or dies.
You mentioned,
and I believe it's a whole different issue if someone is hooked up to a machine
mm-hmm.
versus the problem I sometimes have is I hear about these cases where people are in a coma, their eyes can follow individuals, sometimes they can even maybe squeeze their hand, they are conscious, but they have a feeding tube because they
mm-hmm.
cannot. Now, lots of people who can even talk can't feed themselves because they can't use their arms.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole what happens to the whole question of do we stop the feeding tube and let them starve to death? Because that is what's being done very often, because relatives say they wouldn't want to live like this.
Well, it's the advent of advances in medical technology that have caused many of these problems. 200 years ago, we wouldn't even be discussing this to a large degree. Rush room.
Shortly after the war, I became better acquainted with a minister, an older man, who had been in a coma in a hospital for 6 months, wasn't conscious the whole time, and he did recover. I was able with a cane to get around tolerably well, and subsequently became a chaplain in an old folks home. It was a most amazing recovery. On the other hand, in the early 50s, I knew this man who had taught science and had a very considerable knowledge of things medical, who had had a series of light strokes. And he told his wife very emphatically, "I know enough to be able to tell when a stroke is coming. And when the big one comes, just let me die in bed here. I'll go quickly. And I'll let you know," because he said, "I have learned with all the series of strokes I've had since I retired a great deal about what is happening." Well, this one day, he told his wife, "This is it, the big one. Let me die here at home." Well, the married daughter was a true blue liberal, and she came over as soon as her mother called her and persuaded her mother to call an ambulance and take him to the hospital, where he lived for months. And instead of having enough money to live on for the rest of her life, it cost her all the money that her husband had saved up, and the lovely house they had. And then she had to move in with that daughter who made her life miserable because she felt imposed upon. Now, I do think that the problem we have is that both in continuing life and in trying to cut it off, men are trying to play God.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And both efforts are really immoral.
That's right.
It was very sad, in the case of that widow. She was now in a church that was modernist to the core. Everything that she heard offended her and upset her. She did not like her daughter's very liberal ideas with regard to everything, including child care. It was total misery for that woman. And the daughter created the situation.
Yes.
Well, I think the answer, at least what I arrived at, is that we each individually have to take responsibility for giving our very best effort, our best good faith effort to understand God's will.
That's right.
Yes.
And that's the best you can do.
Mm-hmm.
Just pray about it and make your decision. That's what we have to do when we're faced with something like that.
Because man is not omnipotent and man is not omniscient.
No.
Mark mentioned something I want to pick up on. You know, a lot of natural law advocates oppose euthanasia and abortion because they believe that life has infinite human value. Human life is infinitely valuable. We need to oppose that. I don't like the idea of pro-life. Perhaps we should say pro-law.
Yes.
Because the important thing is not, the most important issue is not that a life is being taken, but that God's law is being broken. And we can't defend it on a natural law basis, but on a biblical law basis.
There was a prominent theologian in Germany who, in the last century, developed a theology which was centered around the belief in the infinite value of the human soul.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we cannot make man's life equal to God.
That's right.
And we cannot speak of its infinite value.
Only God's life is of infinite value. Exactly.
What we have to say, where human life is concerned, we have to go by God's law. Because if we decide that we're going to make the decisions, then we've taken a wrong turn and the world is going to suffer.
Also, we can fall into terrible inconsistencies like Ron Sider. You know well about Ron Sider, who opposes abortion, supposedly, but also opposes capital punishment, you see, because he is pro-life. For him, is man that is the center of the universe, and therefore he has to oppose abortion and has to oppose, he says, capital punishment. That's why we have to be pro-law and not specifically pro-life. It is God's law that is paramount and not man's life that is paramount.
There's another uglier side to euthanasia, which we haven't gotten into, which probably the more classical understanding of the shaping of a society, the shaping of the demographics of a society through euthanasia. Those of us old enough to remember World War II became aware of what Hitler was trying to do in shaping the demographics in Germany. And this seems to be repeated over and over again to one degree or another. You mentioned before about the Netherlands. I don't want to infuriate anybody in the Netherlands, but the general understanding is that one of the reasons that people 50 years old and older won't go to the hospital in the Netherlands is because they have a less than even chance of getting out alive. So they come to the United States or go to England or anywhere else. So what it boils down to is that it's for the convenience of the state.
Yes.
Simply because in their view, they don't have room enough for everybody. Well, now you jump out of that microcosm to what we have here in the United States. The liberals have decided that we don't have enough resources, that humans are fouling the air and fouling the water and fouling the land and so forth, and therefore have to be controlled, like you'd control the number of animals in a cage or in a zoo. So it has broader implications, which are now being carried forward. Where it's going to go, I don't know, but it has ominous signs for the future and has to be opposed.
And some of these cases you hear about, you'll hear their family members interviewed. And it's not really a question of are they alive or not, but, you know, my son or my husband would not want to live with a lack of the quality of life. In other words,
are being put into their mouths by,
right,
quotes, healthcare professionals.
That's right.
People don't make that stuff up.
Talk about the quality of life, and then you have other people saying, well, being paralyzed, being in a coma is not the quality of life. This person was a vibrant, active individual,
yes,
an athletic person. Therefore, I don't believe that they would want to live with this quality of life. And again, it's all centered on man and really man's convenience, not what is moral.
Also, I have to tell you, there's some greed involved in the process.
That's
of,
right.
Over the past couple of years and going through this situation with my mother, I found out that for the first 90 days, you know, under Medicare, assuming you're over 65, Medicare pays the bulk of the hospital bill. After 90 days, in other words, if you're in a convalescent home for an extended period of time, that drops away.
Yeah.
And you become private pay until you run out of money. Well, I found out that in this particular convalescent hospital, they have three wings. There's the private pay wing, there's the Medicare wing. Now, in the Medicare wing, the convalescent hospital can bill the government $170 a day. In the private pay wing, they can only bill $100 a day. Plus, during the first 90-day period, when you first go into a convalescent hospital, they pitch the family on, particularly if you're a stroke victim, on rehabilitation. So you go through a $15,000 to $20,000 rehab program, which is all billed to the federal government. And in 99% of the cases, it doesn't do the person any good, because once you've had the stroke, you know, the mental processes are gone, all the rehab in the world isn't going to get that back. So you follow the money, and you find out that there's good old-fashioned greed involved. In other words,
right,
they need to churn the patients in convalescent hospitals and keep a fresh crop coming in so that they can get that $15,000 to $20,000 worth of Medicare billings for rehabilitation, and they can bill $170 a day instead of $100 a day. So you're talking big, big money when you look at it nationally. Hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars.
Yes. And there have been exposés of how the hospitals have gone beyond that to false billings.
Oh, yes.
It's rife. I was down there, arguments every month. They're billing, they have a little drink called Ensure, which is
yes,
chocolate milk with a bunch of vitamins in it.
Mm-hmm.
I got a billing for $270 for one can.
Oh my.
I mean, I wouldn't think that anybody'd have that much guts to try to get away with that.
Must have been a lot of vitamins.
Yeah,
it?
I think it's about
send you to the moon.
Joanna, Ensure.
Yeah.
How much a can?
$1.25.
You can buy
$1.25.
You can buy a case of 12 cans for $9 at Thrifty.
Well, the medical profession has changed dramatically. I remember reading a little survey taken by nurses, or of nurses, about 15 years ago, in which the majority of them said that the main reason that they were involved in the nursing profession is altruistic reasons, to help people. The same survey was given about 5 or 6 years ago, and most of them said, we got in it because it's a lucrative profession.
You betcha.
It's a lucrative profession.
You betcha. The firms are listed in the stock exchange. And
oh, yeah.
Big business.
Could you repeat again? It was such a shock, I can't remember how much one can of Ensure cost.
Billing was for $271 for one can.
$271
for one can.
$271. Yeah. Now, a lot of mothers use that feeding their babies.
You know what's so ironic about that? I've seen those TV exposés, and I've actually seen doctors defend that kind of charging.
Oh, yeah.
I've seen them defend that.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Well, they're as good as the Pentagon, then.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to shift the discussion slightly, but get back to it basically in a roundabout way. I'm currently reading a very, very interesting, often highly amusing book, P.J. O'Rourke's All the Trouble in the World. Have any of you read that?
I know about him, but I don't know.
All right. Now, one of the things, if I may take a little while with it, because I think it's highly interesting. He has a chapter on Bangladesh, the former Bengal state within the British India. Now an independent country, something of a basket case. He makes it a very interesting discussion of socialist economies, because Bangladesh, when it was under the British, was the world's major source of jute, out of which burlap sacks were made. But lo and behold, sacks are no longer made of burlap. They're made out of plastic, which works better and it's cheaper. So the socialist economy of Bangladesh doesn't have the sense to say, with the rich soil we have, why don't we grow something else? No, they grow jute and more jute, and they're trying to find other uses for jute. And he said they were calling him up, inviting him into state offices to discuss jute with him. Being a journalist, they wanted to sell him on the potentialities of jute. Well, They are making rugs out of jute. The trouble is, it is a rough material. You walk across it and you break the threads, and you have a messy looking rug after you've gone over it a few times. On top of that, it absorbs 25% of its weight in moisture. So in a very humid climate, you walk across the jute rugs and the rugs squish under your feet. But they're sold on jute and they're going to sell it to the world. Well, with this kind of socialist problem, all the authorities all over the world say that Bangladesh has a serious problem, overpopulation. And it looks convincing when you look at the poverty, when you look at some of the slums that are almost unspeakable in their poverty and filth. But what P.J. O'Rourke did was to do a comparative study of another area with the same concentration of population, Fremont, California. Fremont is a middle-class city, does not have a bad section, a low crime rate. In a recent year, they did have two murders. They don't have any problems like Bangladesh, and yet they have the same concentration of people. And that's with all the parks and historic sites and so on that they have there in Fremont. So, after going over that in various ways and calling attention to other areas like Bangladesh, P.J. O'Rourke says, where are these overpopulated areas? Some of them are not as heavily populated as, say, the Netherlands or Belgium or various states of the United States that are big city states. They said all these people are in areas of races that our liberals are not honest enough to say they would like to see diminished in numbers. So he says the idea of overpopulation is a way of advocating the disappearance, the euthanasia of peoples in the world that we'd rather not see. We'd rather have them controlled by us or disappear as they are. We want the kind of world we liberals represent, we white liberals. But he said they're not honest enough to say they want vast segments of the world eliminated. And the whole myth of overpopulation is a way of trying to accomplish the same thing. And this is why we have been working secretly through the UN and other ways to fund depopulation in places such as China, where the one child and no growth idea is so prevalent. So the whole idea of euthanasia, and this is my point, confronts us in a number of ways. I believe it's behind abortion.
Yes.
It's behind the whole myth of overpopulation. It is behind the emphatic teaching in the earliest years of school, including kindergarten, the idea that there are too many people and that we are destroying the earth.
Mm-hmm.
We have increased in the past 50 years the forests in the U.S. by a tremendous percentage. And yet we go on talking about destruction to the forests and destruction to species. And the idea, of course, is we are not to destroy even certain cockroaches, which supposedly are in short supply, or certain kinds of rats. But we are to destroy people created in God's image.
Yes.
I can remember, I was in junior high when Roe versus Wade came down. And I can remember one of the first criticisms of abortion was that it was commonly said that abortion would lead to euthanasia, because killing babies that you didn't find valuable was the same as killing other people, especially elderly people who you didn't consider valuable to society anymore or wanted by society. And that was commonly said, and that was poo-pooed by the proponents of abortion at the time, that it was totally ludicrous to make that association, that it had nothing to do with elderly people, and that it was totally ludicrous to even make that association. And yet here we are, just 30 years later, less than 30 years later, and the whole issue has come around to euthanasia.
No, yes. Abortion is a form of euthanasia.
Sure, yeah. Yes. We can't isolate this one topic from these others, no.
That's exactly. You know, any attempt to shape the demographics of a people by either the front end or the back end is still euthanasia. You're still shaping the demographics.
The abortion advocates always come back to, we don't want unwanted babies in the world.
Yeah.
And you're not going to take them into your home, which is largely a lie,
it
because
a lie.
There are people waiting for babies to adopt. Yeah,
absolutely.
But you don't want these babies, therefore there are unwanted babies, therefore it's the best thing to do.
This quality of life business is totally wrong. I think of what God said to Moses, who made man's mouth? The sovereign God has a right to make those whom he will, and if he wants to make some mentally retarded, he can do so. And who are we to dictate to God who should live and who should not live?
In the 60s, I wrote a little book which will be out maybe later this year again in a collection of my shorter writings on the myth of overpopulation. It's hard to look back and realize how intense the furor over that book was. It was noted even in the Wall Street Journal, favorably, let me say. But when I, at that time, for the Intercollegiate Society of Individualists, made a tour of a number of university campuses to speak on that subject, twice there were near riot conditions. And at one such university in the Midwest, a major technological university, there was quite a long and intensely volatile period after I spoke of discussion and debate. And this one Hindu student, who apparently was high, upper caste, got up to say, but there are too many people of the wrong sort in the world, and they should be eliminated. And afterwards, a girl told me that, I don't understand your position. You surely must realize there are too many people of the wrong sort. And it was interesting. I spoke at a prominent Christian school, and I was to have had lunch afterwards with the faculty. They wouldn't sit with me. So the student body president and his girlfriend took me to the faculty dining room, and the three of us ate while the faculty sat around looking at me as though I were a pariah.
The Sanhedrin down on the
yes. Road. But the interesting thing was that I called attention to the fact that a high percentage of the abortions. And I had at the time a clipping from the Santa Ana Register in my hand were among black women. And there were a number of black students there, basketball players and others. And they immediately came around me like a bodyguard to escort me out of the auditorium.
You remember, Rush, right after World War II when the communists took over in China, I was always amused by the long succession of five-year programs, like yes. they couldn't get it right. And what happened, they were supposed to send these people out into the countryside to count heads and see how much food production they were going to need to feed themselves. Well, apparently, a lot of them didn't bother to, they just sent back some numbers and didn't bother to actually count heads, because all of a sudden, hordes of people started showing up in the big cities because they heard that there was free food. Here's all these guys out digging ditches in the hinterlands, and they got the word that you could go down to the big city and they'd hand out free food. So they all dropped the shovel and left for the big city. But it's what tickles me in a perverse way about this euthanasia thing. It's really government's admission that they cannot do the job that they seek to do. It's an admission of failure when they have to resort to controlling the number of people, just like the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia had to kill 20 million of their own people in order to get the numbers of the population down to a point where they thought they could handle it. Mm-hmm. And it's always been government's answer. If you can't solve the problem, kill a bunch of people until you get the problem down to the size you can manage.
Well, that began with the French Revolution, although they don't talk about it anymore.
That's absolutely right.
They were trying to figure out how many should we eliminate to have the right number to work with. Going back to P.J. O'Rourke's book, he has a passage there about population figures. And he said, what you must realize is nobody has gone through Bangladesh or India or any of these countries in Africa or Asia or elsewhere to count the people. What they do is this. They're applying for foreign aid or something from the World Bank. And the more people they have, the more money they can get.
Sure.
So they send in figures that run into the tens and hundreds of millions down to 346 or some figure like that, as though they had an absolutely accurate count of the entire population. But it has one purpose, to get money. And of course then the overpopulation people and the euthanasia people will talk about too many people based on these manufactured figures designed to get money out of the European and U.S. countries.
Well, it's just like the guy that made the statement there were 6 million homeless in the United States, and when they actually got down to counting, they could only find a couple hundred thousand people that fit the description.
Yes.
You know, this idea of defending euthanasia, as you alluded to earlier, Rush, is prominent in a number of schools, even at the smallest age. These little open-ended questions are quite popular. If you were on a boat with an elderly person and a younger person, and the boat were going to sink and only perhaps two could be saved, which ones would you save? And forcing children into moral dilemmas like that is very evil, and it's very pervasive.
One of the things that tickled me to wander a bit in P.J. O'Rourke's book is his tour of the Amazon country by a boat, stopping here and there at camps. And of course, the tour is very popular with the environmentalists. He describes the absolute horror of it. All you see are endless trees and brown, dirty water. You stay in camps that you wouldn't put a convict in. And They're supposed to be things that you rejoice in because you're back to nature. He describes conditions that are barely repeatable with no end of humor. I enjoyed reading many portions of the book thus far as I have read Dorothy. But he does puncture these environmentalists and overpopulation people and others. And Al Gore.
Well, a lot of the third world countries have objected at the recent conference in, where was that, Cairo?
Cairo, mm-hmm. Yeah.
There was a great deal of opposition to the demand for, to promote abortion. There was a great deal of opposition to that. And in fact, it was something, the conference was turned out to be something of a fiasco.
Yes.
For its promoters. These minority groups, these third world groups, the implications of this isn't lost on them.
That's right.
And the same is true in the black community here. A lot of people are very upset with the idea of promoting population control amongst the black people, mm-hmm. because they think it's a way of to get rid of black people and to reduce the size of the black population.
Well, rightly so.
That's right.
You know, once it gets loose, it's a monster, and it can consume anybody, not just black people.
That's exactly right. Black people should be out in the forefront opposing these things.
And a lot of the same people will criticize the conservatives who talk about family values.
And how
silly that is. Only the real problem in the black community is not the number of black people, it's the fact that it's a total breakdown of the family structure.
Absolutely.
Helped along by the government.
In fact,
the government is the chief element in the breakdown of the
absolutely.
Family among black people.
Government has been subsidizing immorality and evil since FDR and probably before. We're hoping that changes pretty soon, but that's something we have to pray and work for.
Well, I think the Cairo conference was particularly important because for the first time, many of the third world countries, so-called, talked back to the Western liberals.
Yes.
They made it clear they did not agree, and I'm particularly proud that the Christian regime in Zambia was very vocal.
I was just going to bring that up. He was there and was, of course, the liberal press didn't want to hear mm-hmm. these people, but they were quite vocal in opposing the majority liberal view. I was so proud to hear that and read it.
Yes.
Well, I think they're getting less restricted in their criticism of the West because we're not doing a very good job over here.
No.
We have no right to tell them what to do. Uh-uh.
I think these advocates of the myth of overpopulation, euthanasia, and abortion, and so on, forget when they are playing God that there is a God.
Yes.
And that he is not happy with them. So he's going to deal with them in good time. That's why Psalm 2 has always been a favorite of mine.
Yes.
As against the world conspiracy of the ungodly nations, God who sits in the circle of the heavens shall laugh. He shall have them in derision.
That's right. And was it Galatians 5 says that we reap what we sow?
Yes.
We have an abortion and euthanasia culture. It will reap impotence and destruction. And we're seeing that, of course, as it is now.
Well,
it reminds me of talking about playing God. Years ago, my dad had on his refrigerator a Calvin and Hobbes comic strip. A little boy was standing over a little plant with a watering can, screaming at the plant, saying,
"Yes,
I totally control whether you live or die. You do things my way or else." and steady the earth, the water can, and suddenly this cloudburst came, and this drenching rain came down.
Yeah.
This utterly defeated look on his face as he walked away.
Yes. He looked up at heaven sourly at the end.
Yes.
Well, according to Bob, and I've read this too, if the population of the world is given one square foot per person, they would fit in Jacksonville, Florida. And I recall some years ago the fact that I read in a very fine scholar's work that the whole population of the world could be fitted into Ventura County and live comfortably. We've gotten the idea that the world is vastly overpopulated. But there is no country in the world that doesn't have a great deal of wilderness, a great deal of land that is not used, a great deal of land that all that it needs is water. And the fact that we forget is that a great deal of land in the United States that was agricultural at the beginning of this century has reverted to forest. Simply because the productivity of the remaining farmland has increased so dramatically. And this is happening elsewhere as modern methods of farming are exported. In this country, the farm population decreased to less than 10% not too long after World War II, and it's still going down. But we're producing more food than ever before. And yet, in places like China and Russia, they have to have about 50% of the people engaged in farm production. And the reason for it is their inability to use the soil properly. And of course, that is emphatically true of Bangladesh, some of the richest soil in the world. And yet, it is a basket case economically, and it has a continual problem with hunger, and the jute keeps piling up because the government of Bangladesh is determined that the world is going to be sold on the idea of squishy jute rugs.
Mm.
Well, our time is almost over. Each of you have a last comment you'd like to add?
Well, again, euthanasia is the attempt of man to play God, and it's a theological problem, and it must be extirpated right at the root, theologically, and not just a sort of bland religious do-goodism. But we need the full, authoritative, comprehensive faith of the Scriptures preached and applied in all areas of life to solve this problem and all others.
I just think the heart of the problem is man playing God.
Yes.
And if you look at it that way, that doctors don't have the right to play God, and we don't have the right to play God over others, that we keep decisions like this in perspective.
Yes, I agree. And I'd much rather have God be God than any man or myself.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you all for listening, and God bless you.